राधा माधवा कुंज बिहारी Nityananda Prana Prabhu is here. Come. Yes.
Yes, please.
Yesterday I gave some, and then Monday I have to figure it out, so it's very nice.
I thought you were going to be, traveling. I'm so sorry.
I said Sunday through.
But you can give.
No.
I warm it up for you.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
You know you're already doomed when a senior devotee gets up and gives the little guy the chance to speak. So be prepared for a doomed Saturday beginning. So today is Ashok Prabhu's birthday, I believe. Is it? Isn't it? Happy birthday to you. So we will speak about Hanuman on your birthday. Okay, so please forgive me for my, miscalculation of timing. So this is Canto 9. Chapter 10, text 28. Narayanam namaskritya naram chaiva narottamam devim sarasvatim vyasam tato jayamudirayet nashtaprayesha bhadreshu nityam bhagavata sevaya bhagavati uttamashloke bhaktir bhavati naishtike Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Kritesha vidhavalanka Vayamcha kulanandana Deha kritonam grudharanam Atma naraka hetave Kritesha vidhavalanka Vayam cha kulanandana Deha kritonam gridhranam Atpa naraka hetave Kritesha vidhavalanka Vayam cha kulanandana Deha krito annam gridhranam Atma naraka hetave
Thank you.
Krita, made by you. Esha, all of this. Vidhava, without a protector. Lanka, the state of Lanka. Vayamcha, and us. Kulanandana, O pleasure of the Rakshasas. Deha, the body. Kritaha, made by you. Annam, eatable. Ghridranam, of the vultures. Atma, and your soul. Narakahetave, for going to hell. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. O pleasure of the Rakshasa dynasty, because of you, the state of Lanka, and also we ourselves now have no protector. By your deeds, you have made your body fit to be eaten by vultures and your soul fit to go to hell. Purport. One who follows the path of Ravana is condemned in two ways. His body is fit to be eaten by dogs and vultures, and the soul goes to hell. As stated by the Lord Himself in Bhagavad Gita 16:19, Tanaham Vishatah Kruran Samsareshu Naradhamam Kshipami Ajasram Ashubhan Asurishva Eva Yonisho. Those who are envious and mischievous, who are the lowest among men, are cast by me into the ocean of material existence, into various demoniac species of life. Thus the destination of the godless atheists such as Ravana, Hiranyakashipu, Kamsa and Dantavakra is a hellish condition of life. Mandodari, wife of Ravana, could understand all this because she was a chaste woman. Although lamenting for the death of her husband, she knew what would happen to his body and soul, for although one cannot see directly with one's material eyes, one can see with the eyes of knowledge. Pashyanti jnana chakshushah. In Vedic history, there are many instances of how one becomes godless and is condemned by the laws of nature. Madhav Gauranga, can you reduce the volume a little bit, please? Thank you. Om Ajnana Timirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurunmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Mano Bhishnam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamahyam Dadati Swapadantikam Vancha Kalpatarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Srivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So this chapter is a summary of the Ramayana. Shukadeva Goswami is skipping all the details and giving a summary because he says to Parikshit Maharaj, you already heard Ramayana many, many times. So 2 verses ago, Sri Ramachandra was chastising Ravana, or a stool of pigs and things like that. The stool of man-eaters. And fast forward, it says that all these rakshasas headed by Ravana were killed by the arrows of Lakshmana and Sri Ramachandra. So the women of Lanka are running out, embracing the dead bodies of their husbands and crying and lamenting because one person's lust, The price of one person's lust was paid for by the entire kingdom. And what was the price? The death of all the men in the society. So this is Mandodari, the wife of Ravana. She's crying. And in her crying and lamenting, she's saying these words. Krita Esha. Esha is all of this. You have done. Krita Esha. Vidhava Lanka. In Hindi or Sanskrit, a wife, a widow, is called Vidhava. That's the word from here. Vidhava. The word Vidhava is the person who's a protector is called Dhata. Right? Which was that verse that Vaisheshika Prabhu picked, and he asked each one of us which aspect of the Lord you like. Wasn't it Vaisheshika Prabhu? Oh, that was Ikshvaku Prabhu. Oh. So that verse is Dhataram. Dhatara is the one who is the maintainer. You hear the word Dhata somewhere else. Nityo Nityanam Chetanas Chetananam Eko Bahunam Yo Vidhadhati. Vidhadhati is one who is the maintainer. So Vidhava means one without a maintainer. A widowed. So it says, Kritesha Vidhava Lanka. You've made the entire Lanka widowed. You've killed all the men. You're the cause of all the men in Lanka dying. Plus there is something else has happened. Vayamcha and all of us. Kula Nandana. You're supposed to be... And this is a... This is sarcasm, right? When you're sarcastic with someone, you give them the nomenclature or title, and the opposite is what they have done. So if someone has done something very slow, we say, come on, Mr. Speedy, get it done. Or you do something very foolish, and others will say, oh, that was quite intelligent, huh? You're such a smart guy, so brilliant. So sarcasm is meant to, it's a scathing way of saying something was done wrong. So she says, Kula Nandana, oh, you're the pleasure of the Rakshasas, look what you've done. You're supposed to be the scion, like how we say, Krishna says to Arjuna, oh Bharata, O scion of the Bharata kingdom. Right? So here he says, Kula Nandana, great scion of the Rakshasa dynasty, you've killed all the men. Shame on you. You're the cause of the entire Lanka becoming kingless, or to put it into a state of anarchy, potential anarchy. And what has happened to you for all your behaviors? What is the outcome? Dehakrita annam gridranam. Dehakrita, you've made your body annam, eatable for vultures. Vultures like to eat carcass. What does it mean your body has become fit for the vultures? It means even your sons who were supposed to perform the last rites in such a way that is fit for ascending to heaven. We do last rites. When a person dies, there are last rites. According to Vedic tradition, the last rite is to cremate the body, because it is the cleanest and the quickest way for the soul to let go of the body. Because when you cremate, all that is left is some ash. Whenever I speak of ash, I remember this one, so I'll say it. many of us know Rati Prabhu. Rati Prabhu's brother was also a devotee, Govinda. When he was a young man, he had long hair and he used to pump iron at the gym. He wanted to be ripped, his body wanted to be ripped. So he met this devotee who was speaking to him about Krishna consciousness. And he said, no, more important is to have a ripped body. So then after some back and forth, that devotee told him, you know, you want to have a ripped body and you think my body is this way and that way. You know, what's the difference between you and me? So he said, no, what's the ultimate difference? He said, when you die and I die, my ash will be in a smaller urn and yours will be in a bigger urn. That's about it. Because you have so much muscle over there. The point he was making is, in life, there is something more critical and more important and more urgent. And whether or not that is one is spiritually centered is far more important than whether one is physically in this way or not. Not that physical is not important, it is, but not above one's spiritual journey. So she says, your body, which should be cremated with grandeur, with the proper mantras, and done by your son, unfortunately, is just sitting on the battlefield, and the vultures are hovering above, and you'll be eaten by them as if you're a very ordinary person. Shame on you that you're dying or you're dead without any glory. You haven't left any glory behind you. So it is said that what you take from this world dies when you die. But what you give to this world remains even after you die. So anyone who's living their life with only taking from the world, their glory, whatever it is, ends when they die. But if they've dedicated their life to giving, even after they leave, their glory remains. So, dehakrita annam ghridranam plus atma naraka hetave. And your soul is headed for hell. So it's a fantastic birthday verse as to where is our life and what's the priority in our life. Krishna picked the wonderful verse for birthdays. Kritesha vidhava alanka vayam chukula nandana. So she is very sad. And now in Bhagavad Gita, one of the reasons Arjuna gives for not fighting, he says that if all the men on the battlefield are killed, then all the women are left without protection. And when they are left without protection, they become targets for exploitation. And when they are exploited, we will have... Come on, Bhakti Shastra. We will have unwanted progeny, Varna Sankara. Varna Sankara means, Sankara is, there's a difference between Sankara and Shankara. Shankara is Lord Shiva. Sankara means rejected. Varna Sankara means basically a bunch of fellows who don't know what their occupation is, they have no direction in life, they're aimless, they're jobless, and they're just wandering about. They're bums. Varna Sankara, they're rejected because they have no place. They don't know what their psychophysical nature is. They don't know what their occupation is. They don't know what their calling in the world is. They're just aimless because they were conceived like that. They were conceived without a purpose. So they will find themselves wandering about and they will create even more havoc. So she's saying, and such persons are not good for the overall society, because society is individuals working towards a common cause. And nowadays we find society not functioning so well because the common cause is not clear. Earlier it could be patriotism. But even within patriotism, there are so many different ideas. People don't like their leaders, etc., etc., that the cause of patriotism also has become weakened. Or it would be then some other ideology around which people gather. So when people gather around an ideology, then they can move together. They try to work in a cohesive way, where they gain from each other's strengths and they compensate for each other's inadequacies. So for us as the Hare Krishna devotees, we have a common ideology by which we move together, trying to accomplish whatever we are supposed to accomplish together. And what is that ideology? What's the ideology you're working for? Silence is golden. Come on, humor me. Going back to Godhead, the ideology that we are supposed to unite around is may Krishna be pleased. Because my idea of going back to Godhead may seem a little different than a way than what you want. But may Krishna be pleased is the ideology that Prabhupada taught us. That may Krishna be pleased. So yesterday I heard something very wonderful. I'm not going to explain it too much, but you get the point. There is a world of difference between may Krishna be pleased and may Krishna be pleased by me, or by Krishna be pleased with me. May Krishna be pleased is our actual ideology. May Krishna be pleased with me is a selfish ideology. Because I'm at the center of it anyway. Because it's not may Krishna be pleased with me. More important is may Krishna be pleased. And so that would mean if Krishna's pleasure is that some other devotee get the credit or that service or whatever because they're better at it or they're much skilled at it or they have a better consciousness, may they do that service. Or if I'm the servant of the servant, then Krishna is more pleased with that idea than so much by me. Anyway, so here are the consequences of a person, especially in a position of some influence, when they do certain things without consideration of the consequences, what actually happens? Now, Ramayana has a list. There are about 25 verses in which the sages... Here's the scenario for you to appreciate. Dasarath Maharaj has exiled Rama and Lakshmana to the forest. And Bharat and Shatrughna have gone north to meet their maternal uncle, Kaikeyi's father. So right now in Ayodhya, except Dasarath, there is no prince left. And because of the pain of separation of Lord Ram, Dasarath Maharaj, in the sense of separation and agony and guilt, dies at night in his sleep. Next morning, when the bards come and sing the songs and play the instruments and all the maids and whoever, the servants come to wake up the king, he doesn't wake up. So then they shake him gently and he doesn't wake up. And suddenly they're all wailing and crying because they realize there is no heartbeat, there is no pulse, there is no sign of life left anymore. So then when they are all crying, the body has to be cremated immediately. But there is no son to do it. All four are gone. So they preserve Dasarath Maharaj's body in a vat of oil. Till one of the sons returns, Bharat returns, and they send messengers, please go and bring Bharat urgently back. So before they send out this message, all the sages have gathered. Vasishtha has gathered with Jabali and Markandeya Rishi, and there's a whole long list of great thinkers. And they consider, in these 20 verses or 25 verses, they start with the word, when there is a lack of a king, when the kingdom is bereft of a leader, like that. And they give so many, almost 40 to 50 things that happen when there is a state of anarchy. There's no king. Very fascinating verses. Whole long list. People cannot go. They will have to lock their doors. They're afraid to wear their jewelry and walk on the street, etc. There's a whole long list. So they send for Bharata. And the night before Dasaratha dies, and this is why I'm sharing this, the night before Dasaratha dies, he tells Kaushalya a story. A story of why he is bearing the loss of his own sons. Loss means Lord Ram and Lakshman have gone away to the forest. But why? And this is karma. This is how things come back to us. So he says, when he was a young prince, he was not married yet, he was a young prince, and he had, as all princes do, he went to the forest for hunting, to develop his skill at archery. And he had a gift. The gift was that Dasarath Maharaj could shoot an arrow and hit the target without seeing the target. He could only hear the sound, and he could tell the direction and perfectly aim at the target. What a skill, huh? Many of us can see the target and miss it. He doesn't even have to see it. He just has to hear a sound. So one night, he's in the forest, and as he's walking through the forest looking for deer and elephant or some animal to hunt, he hears some noise. Some noise like that. And he thinks it's a tiger or some animal that is roaring softly. I don't know if you've seen any of the National Geographic videos where the tigers and lions come out at night and these guys film them at night. It is so pitch dark, okay, that if the lioness is sitting like 6 feet away from you, you cannot see her. But she can see you very clearly. You cannot see her. It's that pitch dark. So in that darkness, when he heard the sound, he shot his arrow in that direction. So the arrow found its target, but it was not a tiger. It was a young boy who was dipping a pot into the river to fill water. And you know, when you dip a pot, it makes this gurgling sound. So he mistook that sound to be the roar of a tiger. And he shot the person in the heart. So when he went to see, oh, can I claim my tiger? He saw this boy with this pot broken and writhing in pain. So he said, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry, what happened? So the boy says, I don't know what wrong I have done for which I'm being killed today. And Dasarath Maharaj says, oh, I'm very, very sorry. Please tell me, how can I mend this? How can I set it right? He said, you cannot set it right anymore. It's an arrow you've shot. Just pull the arrow out. He says, if I pull the arrow out, you will die immediately. He says, yes, let me die immediately. However, I'm not worried about my own death. What I'm worried about is I have two blind parents at home. They're very old. And I'm their only eyes. And I'm their only support. And all I was doing was serving my parents. Now when I die, what will happen of them? And I'm worried about them. So can you please go home and tell my parents what you've done? Dasarath Maharaj says, absolutely. And he pulls the arrow out of his heart. The boy you know, struggles for a few moments and dies, and there's blood all over. So Dasarath Maharaj goes back to the hermitage, and the old parents, because they cannot see, when they hear the sound of someone coming in, they say, "Oh, my son, where have you been? We've been a little anxious for you, because it seems like it's night time. You're not around. We're worried for you. Are you all right?" And Dasarath Maharaj says, "I'm sorry to inform you that your son has died. And I'm the cause of his death." And he explains what happened. So the old man, who's a sage, he says, "Normally, if my son was killed like this, I would have cursed you to die immediately. But the fact that you have come here and you are confessing on your own, I will only leave you with this, that you too will feel the pain of loss of your son." Now one may wonder, why is he cursing? The idea is what the sage is saying is he's an instrument at speaking out the law of karma. What you put out to the world, what comes back to you. If you fill the world with whatever your capacity is, you fill or you give kindness, kindness comes back. You give love, love comes back. You do harm, harm comes back. This is just how the world operates. So Dasarath's been cursed this way, that he will also experience the loss of his son and die in that separation. So Dasarath Maharaj narrates this story, and he says that a man, an intelligent man, must be careful, man, woman, whoever, must be careful that their actions and words have consequences. And before they say and do, they must consider what consequences my words and actions will have. That's one. And second, a person who only rejoices in the immediate gratification, in the immediate benefit, is a fool number one. And he gives this analogy. The immediate gratification is, he says, when you see a mango tree and you see that its new blossoms are tiny flowers, very, very tiny. Have you ever seen a mango blossom? Okay. These are these purple leaves, and at the end of those purple leaves, or at the apex is, are these tiny flowers. These are mango flowers, which in future become mango fruit. He says, when a person looks at new buds of a mango sprout, and he looks at the small flowers, and he says, "Ha, this is useless, too small." Instead, he cuts off the mango tree and plants a palasha tree. I don't know what's the... I forgot to check on the botanical name for a palasha tree. But a palasha tree has big flower. And in course of time, that big flower develops into tiny berries. The mango flower, which is small, in time becomes a big, massive, juicy fruit. And palasha, which is a big flower, becomes a tiny berry. Okay? So he says, when you look at the very immediate gratification and you think, small flower, ha, big flower, yeah! In due course of time, the return you get is very small. Isn't that the lesson in Bhagavad Gita? Happiness in the mode of goodness is suffering now, enjoyment later. Happiness in the mode of ignorance is enjoy now, suffer later. It's that ignorance of long-term consequences. Now, to make it more general, in life, when we do certain things, if we miss out the big picture, the long haul, the long-term benefits that I want, if I miss that out and I just think of the immediate gratificatory things, then I am bound to making horrible choices for which I will suffer severely later. That is Dasarath Maharaj's lamentation. And that is exactly what Mandodara is saying. Although he is also saying after the fact, she is also saying after the fact. And she's saying, look what has happened. Of course, she's speaking to a dead body. He can't fix anything anymore. But the lesson is for us that this guy's lust was so insatiable that despite millions of advices by all the grandfathers, uncles, brothers, subordinates, they told him, please don't follow this lust. Give Sita back. No. And so, against all good advice, he fought with Rama. And this guy could kill all the demigods if he wanted to, but was defeated in the hands of monkeys, led by a very simple human being, supposedly. Lord Ram in the human form, or human-like form, killed by monkeys. This is like really shameful. A monkey army defeated a Rakshasa army. And she says, you've made the entire Lanka widowed, orphaned. And you have left us women also shelterless. Very irresponsible on your part. And what happens to you, Ravana? Your body has become food for vultures and your soul's going to hell. So what have you achieved at the end of life? Nothing. You've become stool. You were samosa yesterday, today you're stool. So this is what the Vedas say, that what's the grandeur, what's the greatness of a body, if not used in Krishna's service, it ends up as one of three things: ash, dust, or stool. Ash, because when you're cremated, all that remains is ash. If you're buried, all the bugs and worms and things will eat and you become dust, or the vultures and carnivorous animals will eat you and you become stool. So the absorption in the body, endless absorption in the body, has only one of three consequences: ash, dust, or stool. Rather, you had missed the great opportunity of meeting Lord Ram and becoming his servant. What a disgraceful life. That is her lamentation. Any questions or comments? Go ahead.
I'm wondering, we hear that Ravana is either Jaya or Vijaya, I'm not sure which one, in the spiritual world.
Jaya.
Then we hear like these pastimes that he's going to hell. Or with Shishupal, it said in the Bhagavatam, it says that he merged into the body of Krishna and became impersonal liberation.
Yeah,
but we know that they're actually devotees. So how do we understand that?
Well, that's not difficult. Each one of us is an actual devotee. In our swarupa, each one of us is an actual devotee. Yeah. But when we forget that, through the agency of false ego, we forget that we are devotees of Krishna. And we live according to the designation of that body. And because we are living in that designation of the body, we experience hell or heaven. And regardless of hell or heaven, some or the other, because the system itself is very merciful, we are coming back to the human form of life to start afresh. So if we have the great fortune or misfortune of fighting directly with Krishna, there's a different consequence. But the point is, Hiranyakashipu and all these fellows had such such power that the Lord himself had to come to set it right. In our cases, that ain't happening. But even for such atheists, because they were killed by Krishna, they get that Sayujya Mukti. But it's not that because they're devotees, because it's part of the curse. But the point is, every one of us is a devotee of Krishna. That's our identity. But we're wandering around, forgetful of it. So we get karmic reactions. Therefore, Prabhupada writes, the destination of godless atheists such as Ravana, Hiranyakashipu, Kamsa, Dantavakra is a hellish condition of life. He didn't say they all get Sayujya Mukti. He says a hellish condition of life. In not specifically, but in principle he's talking. In principle. We're all devotees. This is our innate nature. Just that we are living in ignorance. Acting in ignorance. And suffering in ignorance. Does that help? Yeah, go ahead.
The pastime is that they're cursed like so many times, and then after that they get to go back to their position, right? Is that
yeah, three lifetimes. They're asked so many lifetimes, or three lifetimes, and you come back. I said three lifetimes.
So, I guess the pastime, the demonic pastimes, is more an example for the demons, people with demonic tendency in the material world to learn from that. And that's what Prabhupada is saying, that such as this, but they're not actually going to hell. Like Ravana.
No, he's saying the godless atheists such as have a hellish condition of life. So look at the, always learn from the principle. The principle is that these three or two had three lives, and in all conditions they died very, very horrifically in the hands of Lord Narsingadev, with the arrow of Lord Ram and the chakra of Krishna. The end is always horrible. That's the point. They may be very great persons in the world, but the end is very horrible. So instead, we may not be great in the world, but let our end be glorious. That's the point he's making. So now specifically, Jayan Vijay is a whole different pastime. That's a specific issue. But it's not that the atheist should say, oh, doesn't matter, I'm getting Sayujya Mukti anyway. That's not the point. The point is the end is horrible. You know? In South India, there was an atheistic chief minister. Like how we have governor here, there's chief minister. And the temple of Balaji, which is very rich, and a lot of pilgrims come and they give big, big donations. It is so big that their money counting room has, each shift has about 60 men, 60 or 100 men. And the shifts are 24 hours. So every 8 or 10 hours, the shifts change. 100 men will come again. And there's no stopping of counting what's coming in. Now we do once a week, Saturday for an hour. 100 men, 365 days, 24 hours, in a room as big as our temple room, and they never stop counting. That's the donations Balaji attracts. So the chief minister decided, hey, good money. So he said that the government now owns the temple. It's called nationalizing. They own everything. And what he did was write, it's like opening a McDonald's in Mathura. Yeah, you really rub it in. There's a McDonald's in Mathura. I think they shut it down now. So you to rub it in, on Tirupati, he started these Christian missionary schools, just to rub it in. and took away Balaji's money, or wanted to take away Balaji's money. So everyone was very deeply disappointed and hurt, but they couldn't do it. This guy is very powerful. One day he was flying in a helicopter from one place to another, and his helicopter crashed on the hills of Tirupati and he died. They couldn't even find his body. Sayujya Mukti. We don't know what happened to the guy. I don't know if it's Sayujya Mukti, but you know, you get the idea. So that's the principle, that you may be very great and you may cause great damage, but the end is horrible. Yeah, she's saying, Kulanandana, you're the scion of the entire Rakshasa dynasty. What has become of you? You become food for vultures. Yuck. That's the principle. A great life is not how you live it, but great life is also how you leave it. Okay, anyone else? No problem.
Hare Krishna. Prabhu, I had this doubt, like in Kali Yuga, whether the reactions to what we do becomes lesser in magnitude, like in previous ages, like as we were talking about Dashrath Maharaj, the karma he faced, or even Dhritarashtra because of killing the birds. We see in Kali Yuga so many, like in our minor dealings also, so many things we do like by mistakes. So is the reactions like become lesser? In the case of like example is Jai Vijay also, they did, I mean in that past time that they did, like we heard so many bad things more than all the other, but Mahaprabhu's mercy was so much that everything was vanquished and then they improved themselves. So is it that in the Kali Yuga in general, like is it that the reactions become less, and especially after?
No, in Kali Yuga it's not that reactions become less. In Kali Yuga it looks like the reactions are less because the magnitude of our mischief is also small. The magnitude of our mischief, wrong deeds, is small. So the reaction is small. We are not powerful like Ravana that can lift the whole Kailash mountain and shake it up. We can barely lift a sack of potatoes. And you'll see by the time Bhoga comes how it is. So our magnitude of mischief is small, so the reaction is seemingly smaller. If the magnitude is large, the reaction is large anyway. Yeah. The laws don't change in Kali Yuga. The laws become a little less stringent only in the sense that in Kali Yuga, we are not punished for our thoughts. If that were the case, Hare Krishna, every moment we should be punished by some... Because in Satyuga, the thoughts are not bad. It's the rare thought for which they're punished, or it has a consequence. I shouldn't say punished. Consequence. In Kali Yuga, every thought is horrific. That's why, thankfully, you know, people cannot hear our thoughts. If they could, oof.
The protest that took place out at O'Hare Airport about 10 years ago for the closing of the temples in India, were you there for that?
No, we sent, some of the devotees went.
Yeah, yeah. I have the pamphlet. It's... I'll show it to the devotees if they like to see it. And his name was Reddy.
Yeah, he was not Reddy.
He was the prime minister. Well, he was
chief minister,
governor of the state. But interesting story.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mohit. You had something.
Prabhu. What a practical takeaway also can be is whatever our disposition is, whatever our duty is in this material world, that we take it seriously and we take into account that our actions have long-term consequences.
Our what has long-term consequences?
Our actions have long-term consequences. So from this verse, what I'm taking away, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is whatever our position is in the world, we have to be cognizant of the long-term consequences, like you were mentioning, of our actions. Because if we do our duty, we have done the work of this material life. But if we misuse and don't do the duty that we're supposed to do, then our consequences can be we can go back. And all that.
So if I may slightly modify that, first of all, to know what our duty is, it's not easy. Generally, we think of duty in terms of roles that we have to play. That's only one part, though. There is a whole set of duties that we may not be aware of. We call it swadharma. There are two swadharmas. One is swadharma at the bodily level, because of all the roles we play, father, husband, citizen, whatever that is. Then there is another swadharma, atma. So there are duties associated with that. So Narada Muni says, you may do this set of duties excellent. You're a great father, you're a great husband, a very conscientious citizen of this world. But if you haven't done this dharma, at the end of life, you haven't gained anything. You get zero. At best, you get a heavenly position, which is as worse than zero. But you get heavenly position. On the other hand, one may not do this so well, but is conscientious, not do it so well. Not that one has to be negligent or callous about it. One may not do it so well, but parallelly does this duty, and that person is considered higher. Tyaktva asadharmam charanam bhujam harer. It's a very oftenly misunderstood verse. Okay? People think that because this is more important, I can be negligent of this or callous or that's the wrong understanding. Because doing this, how much ever we try, Krishna says in this material world, every person in his duty will do something wrong or erroneously. It's just the nature of this world. It's in the 18th chapter. Whatever you try, however good a father, a husband, a citizen you want to be of this world, something you will do is not correct. Just the nature of this world. So parallelly, alongside, the other duties must be going on to actually make these duties shine. If this is not done, and only this is done, then Narada Muni says, one hasn't gained anything in this world. One second, it's not working. Goloka, what's going on? Yeah, it's working now.
Okay, so basically another way maybe look at what you just said is if you don't combine those two, then the end result will not be sufficient.
Even if seemingly is wonderful, it's nothing.
Right, so it's not about just fulfilling material duties, but it's fulfilling material duties with your ultimate duty, your spiritual duty.
Very good, correct.
Right?
And so that's the first part of my response. And the second is, one may want to do one's duties conscientiously, but one is not aware of what one's duties are. Awareness comes from just seeing. And Prabhupada writes in the purport, it's not what one sees with material eyes, but one can see with the eyes of knowledge. Pashyanti jnana chakshusha. So seeing with the ear is more powerful than seeing with the eye. This is what we just did at IIT this past Thursday, 2 days ago. The seeing with the ears is more powerful than seeing with the eyes. Seeing with the eyes is, oh yeah, I'm a father, I'm a husband, and you know, I gotta fix these things. But seeing with the ear is that these are all Krishna's parts and parcels, and that is why I'm supposed to do what I'm doing. Because they, as parts and parcels of Krishna, not just they, but every living entity, is not visible to the eye. It's visible to the ear. Meaning, without transcendental knowledge flowing into the ear, we cannot tell that each person is a living part and parcel of Krishna. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So, it is important that as a person walks out of his or her door to take on one's duties, they should be armed with the knowledge through the ear. Meaning hearing transcendental knowledge every day.
Yeah. So, or in other words, you can't fulfill your material duties without the proper understanding of transcendental knowledge.
Exactly. Fantastic. That's Prabhupada's point here. Very, very critical. And when we challenge the students, of course at IIT we're a lot more funny and free-spirited. I can't use the same language here. But when I challenged the students, they all said, seeing with the eyes is more powerful than seeing with the ears. I said, okay, here's the classic example. There is a high-tension wire that has 40,000 volts running through it, and the board says, don't touch. Can you see the electricity? No. You want to find out by touching it? No. You hear it, that someone has said, don't touch it. Because if you touch it, you will not be there to tell others that it is true. Oh, yeah, yeah. So seeing through the ears is more powerful than seeing through the eyes. This was Bhaktisiddhanta's chastisement of his disciples in Vrindavan. You want to hear the story? Is that okay? Kishore Das. So Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur took his disciples for Vrindavan Yatra and used to speak in the evenings. So when he was speaking, a bunch of his sannyas disciples were not in class. They came late. So he asked them, where were you? Why are you not in class? Where were you? So they said, Guru Maharaj, we went to take darshan of all the deities in Vrindavan. So he said, what did you see? Black stone? That's all you can see. And he said, you see Krishna through your ears, not through your eyes. Because without transcendental knowledge, if you come in front of the deity, what will you see? Statue, marble statue, or whatever that statue is. But when you hear from Guru and the disciplic succession, when you come, you say, oh Krishna, you're standing here, how can I serve you? So he said, it's more powerful. That Prabhupada saying, Jnana Chakshusha.
Regarding the analogy you use with the mango tree, flower, and the palas tree.
Dasharatha Maharaj uses that example.
The palas tree is called scientifically Uttea monosperma, and this is called the forest fire.
It's called what?
Forest fire.
Forest fire.
Agni flower. And it grows in the semi-desertic areas in India. So what I wanted to say.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We have been biologically enriched. No, thank you. I appreciate it. Because I couldn't get time to find out what that palasha flower is. Okay. Anything else? Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.